Hi, this is Lori, your host of Happiness Hangout, a space to come and elevate your happiness levels. You, me, and our guests will discuss and help you apply happiness to all aspects of your life, even if you're already happy. Get your daily boost of information to help you feel your best. Well, hello, everyone. This is Lori Peters at the Happiness Hangout, a place and space to help you feel your best. We're so glad you're joining us today, especially with the Happiness Hangout and having our guest, an executive happiness coach. It's going to be a wonderful day talking about how to elevate and keep your happiness levels up. So speaking of guests, I would like to introduce our guest. His name is Jim Smith. He is the executive happiness coach. What he does for a living, he's a global provider of executive coaching and a personal and workplace transformation services. His passion is to create a happier world and workplace, one leader at a time. Drawing on 20 plus years of executive experience and 50 plus years as a human being, Jim has coached leaders from 27 countries and 6 continents. He works with leaders to better balance their own lives, dramatically improve their leadership skills, and build more positive workplace cultures grounded in transparency and trust. Jim is also the author of several books on happiness, leadership, and coaching, and he has touched the lives of over 18,000 people through his work on positive emotion and leadership. Finally, and I love this, Jim wants you to know this, his workshop... He worships dark beer, dark coffee, and dark chocolate, and deeply believes that happiness is a decision, not an event. Jim Smith, welcome to the Happiness Hangout. How are you?
I am well, and I am obviously happy to be here, Lori.
Well, thank you very much. And to those of us, the audience here, whether you're going to be listening live via the podcast, Jim and I have known each other. I'm very lucky enough to live in the same area Jim lives, and we run into each other here and there at different events, and really have wanted him to be on the show for a while. So thank you, Jim, for being able to find the time, because I knew you're very busy. Thank you for finding the time to spend 50 minutes with our listeners on the Happiness Hangout.
It's my pleasure, Lori.
Well, great, great. So I really want to start off... You know, people listen to this show because what the show does is it helps people get their happiness levels up and elevate them and keep people as happy as possible. And we know the word happy is kind of a loaded word because it means different things to different people. And I know that you and I know this, but I remind our listeners that, you know, we don't sit around doing cartwheels all day and having, you know, every single moment of life isn't, you know, always an extraordinary situation. But in all fairness, you know, happiness is, like Jim said, it's a state of mind. It's much of it is what you choose. And we all have challenges in our lives. And I think, you know, what we're going to talk about today is how do we get through those challenges easier? What are some things that we can do to feel our best? So just in talking a little bit about Jim, so Jim, our audience gets to know you a little bit better. Talk to us about your experience in happiness. Like, what have you done and how did you get into this field?
Well, I did not always describe myself as a happy person. I struggled with depression when I was in my teen years and in college, and came across stuff, literature at the time, that I believe was kind of fostered by groups like the Optimist Club of America, groups that existed back then. And one of the practices that I latched onto was the practice of saying positive mantras, like saying positive things to yourself on a regular basis. Those helped me for many years. At least it changed my self-talk a little bit. What really changed my life was that very early in the evolution of positive psychology, I came across it as a field of study. And this is years before it launched into the world. Pretty much positive psychology came into the world in the 2003-2005 era. Mm-hmm. Time magazine and all these publications are writing things about it. long before then, I had started to subscribe to the email trails of a lot of the researchers in the field. And in fact, because I was connected with Martin Seligman, who is the father of positive psychology, widely acknowledged mm-hmm. that, I was actually part of the very, very first group of coaches and therapists that he trained globally as authentic happiness coaches. This was in 2003, back when he published his book, which pretty much began the tidal wave of happiness in the world. So I've been practicing it for many years, many of the tools I used to raise my kids. And what I've seen is that when people apply themselves regularly, like actually do the work to help themselves be happier, it actually works. It has a different outcome. People show up in a different way. So that's my background in the area.
Oh my goodness. I didn't realize that you work with Dr. Seligman. That's pretty amazing.
It was pretty amazing, actually. The faculty for our program was global, and it was all the big names in positive psychology that we know about today were back then unpublished researchers.
Mm.
None of them had a book out yet, but they were the faculty that we would have each week for our coursework. When they started to publish books, I remember collecting them all and going, oh, I already heard that from them. Oh, I already knew that. It was very, very fun to have been kind of on the inside track as a lot of this stuff was being developed.
Oh, sure. And you know, it's kind of funny because obviously I work with, you know, individuals, typically not corporate, a little bit, but mostly the individual work. And it's kind of interesting because there's actually people out there who are naysayers about happiness and about the field of positive psychology. And I think to myself, okay, the thing is, there are definitely things that one can do, because when you try these things, they actually work. And I know it works because it's worked for me. As you said, you know, a lot of times we do things because of rough situations, and then it, you know, we try things, it changes our lives so much that we want to spread it to other people. And it is funny because you'll always get the pros and cons to everything, even happiness. So I've always found that very interesting. So if we get back to the very basics of it all of us define happiness differently, I think, and all of us have a different perception of it. How do you define happiness, Jim?
There's two ways I like to define it. One is my favorite dictionary definition. Happiness is the quality or state of being joyous, glad, or contented. And I love that particular definition because it points right away to the fact that happiness is something you carry inside of you. It's not about something that's outside of you. And then the other definition that I like is one that I created. It just kind of emerged from all of my writing and research over the years. Happiness is wanting what you have. Think about it.
I love that. And I think that takes a lot of getting used to for people, because we are taught, you know, if you do live in a capitalist society, we are taught to go for the bigger, the better, always move to the next thing. And I know that wore me down in life. And it's interesting because I have a person in my life who says, I don't understand what you mean about not having other people make you happy, that you can't have other people make you happy. And I try to explain, to say, of course other people can make you happy or sad. We are emotional people. It's just if we let people take us down or up too much, that's where we struggle. I feel that you have to have a base inside you so you can handle all those ups and downs. Because let's face it, people do things the way they're going to do them. It's not going to always fit with what we want. So if you don't mind me going off the cuff a little bit, how do you explain to people about that topic of when there's other people involved? Let's face it, we all have our own agendas and our own ways of doing things. And I feel that if I've got that base within myself that's strong, no matter what other people do, I don't let it take me up or down too hard typically. And I think a lot of people struggle with that because they're counting on other people to make them feel happier.
Yeah, I agree with you that a lot of people struggle with that. So a couple of things for them, for listeners to consider. One is, first of all, let's just remember that even the executive happiness coach here does not advocate that happiness is a place to live all the time. In the work that I've done, we hold that there are about 320 different emotions that human beings can feel. And every one of those emerged in such a way as to help us survive as a species. You know, like fear kept our caveman ancestors from leaving the cave when there was a hungry saber-toothed tiger outside. And so they survived. Fear helped. Anger serves a purpose when someone has harmed you. Sadness connects you to your heart when you have a loss, and so on. And there's a whole family of positive emotions that can serve you as well. But if you're always happy, if you're always in a place of contentment, then what about ambition or expectation? Or, you know, what about moving up or moving forward in the world? So it's equally important to balance happiness with just about everything else. So that's one thing to consider. The other is the concept of emotional resonance. Every one of us is biologically programmed from birth, this is one of the superpowers the babies have, to sense what's going on with other people. A baby will immediately pick up on an adult's anxiety or their calm or whatever else is going on. And we grow up with that. We sometimes forget we can do that, but we grow up with it, and we still have it as adults. So if you walk into a room full of people who are having a really, really bad day, suddenly you can end up feeling like crap yourself. Or if you're in a meeting with people who are, everybody's kind of grumbling and there's problems and everything else, and somebody with a really, really strong, positive attitude, very upbeat personality shows up and joins the meeting, you ever notice how things just shift? Suddenly, the conversation is a little more positive. And that's because our systems are always reaching out and trying to gauge where are other people, and we try and sync up. It's something we do naturally. It's a relationship skill. It's a human skill. But if you're not aware of that happening, your emotion can get hijacked anytime you're in the presence of someone who has a stronger emotional space than you. So if you're in a good mood and you don't know how to hold your own emotional space, and somebody who's just a jerk or somebody who's having a really bad day or somebody who's terribly sad shows up, suddenly you're angry or you're arguing or you're crying with that other person, and you might not even know why. So a lot of the skills that I teach people are how to get back to happiness, right? You know, like happiness isn't a place to live, but it's a place that you want to be able to visit when you want to and not depending on other people. Does that make sense?
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. And yes, other people are going to affect us. We are connected, you know, as a human race. I feel like that I'm more watchful of it in terms of if somebody is really angry, sometimes I remove myself from a situation, or maybe I can help the situation. Like you said, when you come in a little more, sometimes if we come in too happy, it pisses people off even more, you know? So you really just right. have to like know how to do that, don't you think?
You have to know how to do that. And it's also important to understand that how you feel is how you feel. You can't mandate that other people feel the same way. Now, maybe you can influence them by your behavior. You can kind of invite them into your happy space. But, yeah, I've had people who met me in conversation and then backed away and avoided eye contact. Like, I don't want to talk to you about happiness. They're just enjoying their anger or they're being pissed off too much. Okay, that's fine.
Right.
But just because you're there doesn't mean I have to join you.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, you talk about actually a practice of it. Can you talk a little bit about the practice of happiness?
Sure. And what I'm hoping we can talk about today are some very specific practices.
Perfect.
First, just the concept of practice. Let me just offer a physical metaphor first. If you wanted to run a marathon or lose weight or lift weights, you know, then you know that you can't just get up and run 26.2 miles. You can't just go to the gym and lift 400 pounds. Because if you do one of those two things and you're not in the right shape, you could harm yourself pretty badly, actually. So how would you approach something from that perspective? Well, you'd start by walking, and then you'd move to jogging, and you'd increase the distance. Or you'd start with 5-pound weights and move to 10 and 20 and 30 and 50 and probably work with a coach along the way to help you get better and better. And after a while, you could run farther, lift more weights, change your eating habits, whatever it is you're going to do physically. And everybody gets that concept. The same concept applies to your emotional muscles and to your thinking muscles. You think in certain patterns. There's ways that you look at the world. There's thoughts that you have that are patterns that you probably haven't even paid attention to. They may have been formed when you were a child or as a teenager or based on your work experience. Certain narratives you tell yourself that are just things you practiced. And in the emotional world, remember I said there's 320 different emotions, most people have like 5 or 6 favorites that they practice every day. Like some people wake up every day and the first thing they do is they mentally go through a list of all the people who've done them wrong. So they have a really, really strong like resentment or anger muscle. And then other people get up every day and they spend the first part of their day making a checklist in their head of all the things that could go wrong today. So their worry and anxiety muscles are really, really strong. And so if you get that concept of practice and you kind of move forward, then you realize that if you instead intentionally focus on building quote-unquote muscle strength in the positive emotion family, what's going to happen is those emotions can show up more easily because they're stronger. When you need to get into a positive space, you'll know how to because your system will be ready for it. Okay, so that's what I mean by practice.
So how do people make that shift? Because, you know, I consciously made that shift as a kid. You know, you mentioned your upbringing. I wasn't a tremendously happy kid. I am about one of the most upbeat persons that people tell me that I am. Part of it was conscious. Part of it just happened. If somebody really said, you know, I don't want to feel this miserable anymore. I'm ready for some better changes. What would you recommend? Or do you have any advice for recommending, you know, really how you go about making that change?
Yes. Yeah, I do. There are a lot of practices within the field of positive psychology. So let me share a few of them.
Great.
The first one, and I know you've done this, is something we call a blessings journal or a gratitude journal. And it goes under a number of different names. It's probably the most well-researched and proven tool in the field of positive psychology. And the way it works is this. Every day, ideally every day, although even if you only do it 3 or 4 days a week, it still has an impact. Take a moment to write down three positive things or good things that have happened for you or in your world in the last 24 hours or the last 48 hours, whatever, since your last entry. And that's the whole exercise. Writing it down is important. Either writing it down or you can type it into a computer journal too, but it's about more than just thinking about it. It's about creating an archive. And that's all you have to do. You can just put it away, come back to it tomorrow, add to it, add to it, add to it. What happens over time is you are practicing focusing your system and focusing your emotional space on feeling grateful. And gratitude is a foundational skill in the positive emotion set. Like in order to be able to experience happiness and joy, you really start by experiencing gratitude, which is simply noticing something that has gone well, something that you enjoyed, something that someone did for you, a good circumstance. It could be huge stuff, you know, like a friend who is having a difficult pregnancy just had a healthy baby, and that's a gratitude. But it could also be really tiny stuff, like, you know, your sweetie actually left some of your favorite creamer in the bottom of the container this morning so you could have it with your coffee. And it just made you smile. Write that down. And then everything else in between. So that is one of the first practices that I highly recommend to people if they're going to start anywhere, is to keep a gratitude journal.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, our show here works around the areas of happiness. I mean, I'm not always so direct where I have a happiness expert such as yourself on, but we do lots of things that help people feel better. And I can't tell you the number of times that this comes up. And I know I've been using it for years. And sometimes I'm stuck in a car. And a lot of times when I get in the car, I'm a college instructor too, and I start to think I have a ways to get to my work at the college. And I'll start to think and I'll get overwhelmed and I'll go stop. And I'll just do a gratitude rant, although I know writing it down's better. But even if I'm thinking it, I find that I can knock myself right out of that space where I feel overwhelmed, because I'll say, wait a minute, you're making this a lot worse than it is. Just do this, this, this person will handle this. You're fine. It just puts me personally in a better headspace. And if I can get to write it down, great. I spent many years having a rough time and having to just stop what I was doing and do a gratitude rant on paper, just to try to pull me out of it. And it's amazing how something really so easy can be so powerful.
Yeah. I love what you call it, a gratitude rant. One of the courses that I took, one of the many courses I've taken to reinforce my skills in this area, included a morning ritual that, along with some mindfulness practices, also included just saying aloud, so you could be in a room by yourself, saying aloud to the universe, essentially, 3 to 5 good things from your last 24 hours. And so I don't write things down every day. Some days I do the same thing you did, which is, oh gosh, I'm a little rushed. I'm not going to abandon my gratitude practice, but maybe today I'm going to verbalize it. And
right.
You're right, it works every time. And, you know, a variation on this theme, a lot of people who are very high in self-deprecating, you know, we can be our worst critics. And a lot of people I meet have trouble in that everyone around them thinks they're great, but they still don't believe it. You know, they're always beating themselves up because they're not perfect. And you know, oh, God, I didn't accomplish that. I didn't finish that. I didn't meet that deadline. A great variation on this theme is to either write down or at least say aloud every day, acknowledge 3 accomplishments, 3 things you did get done.
And right. The
thing is, there's always something. There's always something. Even if it's, you know, I managed to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich without killing anyone. Okay. You know, that might be all you can accomplish on a particular day.
Right.
But if you always only focus on your deficit, then that's the muscle that's going to be really strong, is always noticing your imperfections, versus if you take time every day to say, hey, here's something I did, here's a way that I'm great, here's something I accomplished, then eventually you can get into balance where you notice, yeah, I need to improve, and I am getting some stuff done. And that's a variation on this theme. You can be grateful about yourself.
Well, you know, it's funny that you talk about self-deprecating, because I grew up in Youngstown, you know, a very work ethic, blue-collar town, and, you know, Eastern European, and my parents loved me. It was very obvious, mostly through their actions. And when I got a little bit older, it's funny, I'm an only child and spoiled. And my mother finally let the cat out of the bag and said, you know, we tried to keep you super humble because we were really afraid you were going to be a disaster, you know, a disaster princess. Mm. And but what came with that was a lot of in good fun teasing and making sure I sort of kept my head on my shoulders without getting too big, that head on my shoulders getting too big. A lot of teasing about, you know, hey, you better calm down. You're not that great, kind of thing. But little did they know, you know, I was suffering pretty bad inside because I had terrible self-esteem, which my fiance now just cannot believe that could have possibly been me. But it was. And as I got older, you know, I said to my mother, why do you never compliment me? And she said, oh my gosh. And she told me why, what I just said to you and our audience. And I think, oh, how many people out there, you know, they're not meaning to do things. They both passed away, unfortunately, but I had great parents. But that's the thing that they did, because that's how they learned. And I had to come out of that saying, you know what? When I say I'm great, I don't mean that in an egotistical way. That just means I'm happy with myself. I want to put good in the world. And I feel good about who I am. And I've had to teach myself there's nothing wrong with that. And I think there's a lot of people out there who really have to go inside themselves and find that. And some of them need more help than others. But when you say self-deprecating, I mean, that can really be damaging, don't you think?
Oh, very much so. This is actually a common conversation I have with clients. I work with a lot of senior leaders who still have this, you know, I'm not good enough thing going on in their head, mm-hmm. secretly, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of the distinctions that I offer a lot is the difference between confidence versus arrogance. Or pride versus vanity. They're both kind of the same comparison. When you are confident, you are solid about yourself. When you are proud of yourself, it's about saying, hey, what I did was a great thing. You know, I'm proud of me, or proud of my accomplishment. Whereas when you're arrogant is kind of like confidence on negative steroids. Arrogant or vain, when you are one of those, it's about comparison. So I'm better than you. You know, confidence is, I'm good. Pride is, I did a good thing. Arrogance is, I'm good at this and you're not. Poor mm-hmm. you. Right? Or vanity is, I am so much better than everyone. It's having the same concept about yourself, but one is simply owning it and saying, this is me, I'm not pushing it on anybody, whereas vanity and arrogance get into, you're less than me, and the only way I can feel good about myself is by comparing myself to someone who's less than, I have to tell myself I'm more than, and that damages relationships. Right?
Oh, so much. So, oh, my goodness.
We always want to, you know, look at who I am and feel good about me. And if I can do that, then when I show up in a room or in a conversation, it gives other people permission to feel okay and good about themselves, because I'm not pushing myself on them.
And I think we have to accept the fact that we're human. Like, that took me a while because I was a real, I still am a big go-getter, but I was a go-getter for the wrong reasons in the past. Now I'm a go-getter on things I'm just passionate about. Everything else I'm trying to just kind of give up because I want to really, I'm best at the things I'm passionate about, and that's what I feel I need to put in the world. Well, back in the day, I was doing things for other reasons that might not have been right or good for me. So I think, you know, it's a lot of, it's a little bit of self-exploration to say, wait a minute, you know, like I used to feel guilty if I had a list of 8 things to do or things I was trying to accomplish and I only got 3 done. And, you know, I have to fight that, Jim. Quite frankly, I think a lot of people do. I have to fight that all the time. Going, wait a minute, it's totally okay. You're doing great. And you just have to give yourself permission to be human. We're not, I don't feel that we're put on the earth to have to accomplish tasks every single second. That's only a small part of our lives. And a lot of people, they get so caught up in the minutiae of that that they can't see past it. And that is, that's a very tough thing. And you know, I'm going off on a tangent here a little bit, but while you're talking about senior leaders and work, I'm going to throw something past you that I have been experiencing a lot through colleagues and friends and probably a lot of our listeners out there. I am finding that people are many people that are coming into my world are very dissatisfied with their work, their place of work, the work that they're doing. A lot of complaining about the people that are there, the work itself, et cetera, et cetera. And I wonder if, you know I struggled through this with technology, being required or thinking you're required to be on 24/7. Check your email at 10 o'clock at night. Your boss is going to text you at any time because he or she can do it. You know, technology, it could be a whole conversation for me and you separately on happiness. I know. But I'm just hearing more and more people that are so frustrated with their jobs. And I just wondered if you were seeing that, if you think that's a product of expectation of being on all the time because technology is available, or if, you know, have you noticed that in your out and about workings in life?
I hear that conversation a lot, and it comes, I mean, it's what we call a victim mindset. You know, the world has placed me in this situation. Poor me. I have no control. And I honor that point of view because sometimes people can feel that way or are legitimately stuck in a situation. Perhaps, you know, they're tied to a healthcare plan, or they have transportation issues and they can only work in a certain geographic area. This is the only job they can get, or they've got skill set limitations or things like that. And they can be stuck. But even in those situations, they have a choice with how they look at their situation. There are a number of really, really great, let's just call them modern day philosophers out there who talk about suffering. One, are you familiar with Byron Katie and her work?
Not her work. No, but I've definitely heard of her.
Okay. Well, Byron Katie created a concept called the work, which is a way of moving through problems to understand that the only thing that's creating your problem is you. No matter what somebody else is doing out there, it happened. It's the story you're telling yourself that is creating your problem. So kind of her mantra is that suffering is when you argue with reality. Suffering is when you argue with reality. Mm-hmm. Whatever reality is, it is. And the degree to which you nurture accepting where you are, even if you're calling it, I'm stuck here, right? I'm stuck in this place. I don't have any other options right now. That's simply a fact that there are no other options. Mm-hmm. Some people in that situation will look at it and say, so I'm going to make the best of what I have, and they move forward and they're good with life. And then other people in the exact same circumstance want to tell all their friends and neighbors about how much pain and suffering they're having. Well, no, you're stuck. That's the only fact here. Or right now, for now, this is your only option. But let's look at the fact that you have made choices that have kept you here, or there are certain priorities in your life that you're saying are very important, and that's why you're here. You may not like your circumstance, but you're there as a result of your choices, and your attitude about that is also a choice.
And we also have the choice to make change. If we get into the change thing, oh my goodness. But that's the other thing. I mean, I had a choice at one point. I left a job after 16 years that I was not happy on a day-to-day basis whatsoever. I knew I was doing nobody any good. And I made a choice, and it was scary. But I had to do that to find my passion. Or sometimes people have to do that to find another job or whatever. I wasn't going to live in that. And I think a lot of people, have to realize, well, you're going to have to make a change. And sometimes that's worse for people than living in the horrible situation.
Hmm.
That's the thing. So you're right. It is all about the way you think of it. But do you agree, or do you have something else to offer? Even if you are thinking about it a certain way, if it's not working for you, then accept that. And you got to figure it out, don't you?
You do. And you can do a lot of that simply by asking yourself the question, well, what choices do I have, as opposed to looking at the ones you don't have? I went through 4 corporate layoffs in my life. And because I worked in human resources for some of that time, I was often laying a lot of other people off before I got myself laid off. I've had hundreds of conversations with people and learned how to do it well. But, like how to tell somebody they're losing their job and have them leave the room and say thank you. And mm-hmm. one of the tricks to doing that I learned, and it is a trick that I share with people, I'm transparent about this. I'm not manipulating you or anything. The trick is to be able to say to people, you do not have a choice about losing your job. The job's gone. That's not up for debate. Mm-hmm. Here are the choices you do have. You can choose how you leave. You can choose to leave now. You can choose to go home right now. You can pack up your desk. We can pack it up for you. You can take your used vacation. You cannot. You can do this. You can do that. You can sign the paper now. You can sign the paper later. And we would lay out like 15 different choices they did have. And by focusing people on the next step choice they do have, the thing they can decide, even if it's a tiny thing, we give them their power back. Mm. And what you're talking about with people who, say I'm stuck in a job and I'm miserable, I'm suffering, those are people who aren't noticing that they've given up their power. So what can you decide? What can you choose? What decisions can you make? If you can look at what little things you can control, even if it's not on job. Let's look at what can you decide about in your life. You can pull yourself back into a positive emotional space, and it becomes easier to move forward from there.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because people don't like to feel out of control. And, that's just, again, I think part of human nature. You want to feel like you have some sense of a semblance that, that you're okay. People want to feel okay. And I know in that moment, when there's a job loss, oftentimes in that moment, you don't feel okay. And, I think what you're doing and what you did was really important. And now I find that anything happens now, the first thing out of my mouth are, all right, what are the options? Like, I always believe there are options. And I think if you just say that mm-hmm. one line to yourself, okay, what are the options? I think already it puts you in the right headspace to start thinking about those options, or saying, you know what, I know there's options. I don't want to think about them right now. I'm going to go and work out, or I'm going to go and eat dinner, but I know there are options. I'll be back to it. I need a minute, mm-hmm. especially when right. something really big happens.
Yeah.
So I got off on a tangent there a little bit with you about workplace stuff because I'm very interested in it. But, you know, we were talking a little bit before about practices. And I want to throw out to you the practice of giving back. That's a really huge uplifter in the happiness arena about giving to others, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Given that one of the pillars of well-being is having relationships, you know, having a sense of belonging, being part of a team or a community or a family group or something like that, another powerful thing you can do to pull yourself into a positive emotional space is something as simple as doing an act of kindness. You know, very often when I give talks about happiness, one of the questions I ask is, how many people in the room here, either now or sometime in the past, have volunteered their time, you know, done work not for pay? It's almost always every hand in the room goes up. Everyone's done it at some point. Well, why did you do it, right? That's illogical. You're busy, you're stressed, you don't have the time, and you said yes to doing something for no pay. Why did you do that? And everybody gets it immediately. Because I felt good doing it. Right? I made a positive difference for somebody else. So reaching out and touching other people or doing things for other people, that's the way to relate to others for your happiness. You know, expecting other people to make you happy is very, very different from noticing that when you engage with other people, especially when you do something nice for other people, that it makes you feel good about yourself. So again, a positive emotional practice.
And I think that's pretty well researched too. You know, from what I understand, is it lets off like serotonin and the positive receptors in your brain when you do something for someone else, because they look at you and they smile and they say thank you, and that all those receptors in your brain go off, and that, you know, that makes a lot of sense even scientifically. It's not just, you know, woo-woo up in the air. I mean, it's scientific proof.
It is. There's a lot of work done in the area of neuroscience, neurobiology, around the various chemicals get released. You know, one of the interesting things is that the stress hormone, cortisol, which can be destructive if you live in it all the time, it can eat away your inner organs, right? When you experience a lot of stress, when you experience any stress, the system releases cortisol, and cortisol stays in your system for like 72 hours after an event. And if every day you get up and you go through stress activities again and again and again, you're never letting your body relax from that, because you're just renewing that 72-hour period. Serotonin and oxytocin, which are some of the chemicals that get released when you are in a good mood, unfortunately only last a portion of that time. This is why it is so important to regularly practice positive emotional activities, things that will release some of those positive chemicals, so that you're counterbalancing the stress hormone on a regular basis. So there, you're right, there is real physical science behind all this.
Well, and you know, I think we have to be really careful to those of our listeners out there who overgive, and we say about giving too much, that people will give and give and give, that they don't take care of themselves. We're not saying that you should be in that space, because, you know, the people that can't say no, that kind of thing. What we're saying here, I believe, is balance. Finding that right balance between knowing that if you don't take care of yourself and your needs, you're not nearly as good for other people. So you, especially, I know a lot of people out there who are just always giving. They don't do anything for themselves. A lot of my friends with children. And if you don't strike that balance and say, hey, you know, you're just not going to be the best you can be. So to those out there who think they are overgiving, this was not meant to tell you that you have to go volunteer more, that you have to go give more. I'm sure you're giving a lot as it is. So, you know, we just have to be careful with that.
Well, and that takes us into another area, too. Another important thing to remember is that what the flight attendants tell you on airlines is very, very good personal coaching advice, and that is to take your own oxygen first when the oxygen masks fall.
Right.
A lot of people have heard the kind of the cliche phrase that the best way to raise happy children is to be happy yourself. There's variations on that theme.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really true. If you're taking care of anyone else, one of the things you have to do is learn how to be positively selfish. Learn how to step away and refill your own oxygen tank on a regular basis. I was one of eight kids, and I certainly did not realize this is what my parents were doing when I grew up, but in the rearview mirror, it made a lot of sense. I cannot imagine raising eight children. I barely made it with four. The concept of eight makes me crazy, and my parents did it, and I think one of the ways that they coped with it was that they did not try and spend all their time around us. They made it clear we are adults and we have a life, and I believe most of my life growing up, at least once a month, my parents had a babysitter come in on a Friday or Saturday night, and they would go out to a church dance or a gathering or a picnic or they were Catholic, so it was Holy Name Society. Even if it was a PTA gathering, it was just like they'd get out of the house and go and hang out with adults.
Right.
And that was one of the ways that I know my mom refilled her tank, made sure that she had a little bit of downtime, took care of herself, and was able to show up the rest of the time for us. And I think it's important for anybody who's a caregiver, people who are supervisors, people who are responsible for taking care of others, to remember to do the same thing for themselves.
Well, and I know it's easier said than done sometimes, but it really is okay. I think a lot of times, especially parents, we have to remind them that it's not only okay, it's highly recommended. So, and I will tell you, our time is going by so fast. We probably only have 3 or 4 minutes before we start wrapping up and talking about, you know, what's going on with you and what's happening in your world.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about your five prescriptions for happiness.
Oh, gosh. We've actually worked through most of them. My five prescriptions.
Oh, have we? Okay, good.
I call them prescriptions because I recommend you take one a day, right? Or as needed. So my five prescriptions for happiness are count your blessings every day. We talked about mm-hmm. that. Reach out and touch others. Act of kindness. About that. Fourth one is to just and radio by itself, basically make sure that your oxygen tank takes things that are really creating stress. And then your body. Instead of trying to think yourself into happiness, notice that there are certain things that happen in you physically when you are happier or joyous or grateful. Basically, the things that happen are you tend to stand up a little straighter, your breathing slows down, it drops in your body, you tend to open up, and of course, you smile. So when you feel happy, a smile naturally comes up on your face. So everybody knows that, okay? That's how you can tell if somebody's happy, they're smiling. Well, here's the really cool, powerful thing. You don't have to wait to feel happy in order to look happy. If you take the mind-body connection and work it in reverse, what you'd literally do is if you put on a body of happiness and wear it for a couple minutes, what you will notice is that your mood shifts to match the body. So a little tiny exercise here. I don't know if you're sitting or standing, Lori, but can I just do this on you really quickly?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I just invite you to plant your feet squarely in the ground, shoulder width apart.
Okay.
And whether you're sitting or standing, just allow your spine to expand to its full length so that you're either sitting or standing very tall.
Mm-hmm.
Take a deep breath and let it settle into your body. And notice how when you take a deep breath, your shoulders kind of relax.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure your chin is up and facing out into the world versus down at the ground. And smile. Even if the smile feels fake, which it can at first, I acknowledge that. Even if the smile feels fake, just keep it on. Just keep on a smile. Now, one of the really cool things is that anytime we see somebody smiling, what's the first thing that happens?
The other person smiles.
Right. We tend to mirror smiles. And so you're having a bad day at work, a bad moment, just stand up, put on this body. So I call it stand tall, breathe deeply, smile often. And walk around your office or walk around the hallways for 2 minutes, and what you'll notice is that your mood has lightened up. And if you encounter other people in the hallway while you're walking around, watch what happens. They see a smile on your face, they smile back, which now activates in you the reflex to smile. Your smile becomes more genuine, and by the time you get back to your desk, for reasons you may not be able to explain, you actually feel slightly happier. Mm-hmm.
That actually felt
so that's
really good physically. That felt really good physically, like to do that.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad. I'm happy for you. What a great way to wrap up our conversation.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful. Yeah, to do that just when you're working or you're thinking is to stop and do that. It does feel wonderful. So, well, this has been great information, and I would like you to tell our audience what is going on with you. So, what's going on professionally? What should they be looking for? Your website, or what's going on with you?
Well, there's lots of things going on with me. I'm going through a major life transition right now. I am selling my house, building a new house, moving into a multi-generational home with my daughter and son-in-law and their three kids. So I am practicing managing my own stress every day fairly aggressively. I'm actually using all these tools. One of the things that you asked me to prepare was something to share with the audience. And given that we were talking about looking at things you can do to actually practice happiness, I thought something that people might really enjoy that could be useful is my happiness audit. This is a tool that I created a number of years ago based on the research around happiness and positive emotion. It is a 100-point checklist divided into 10 basic groupings, like relationships and work and self-care. It's a 100-point checklist that you can go through and kind of assess where you are in terms of the kinds of things you do in your life. There's no good or bad score here. It's not like, oh, 68, I'm unhappy. No, it's the kind of thing where you can walk through it, and then whatever the number is, just notice it, then look at some of the things you couldn't check off and say, well, maybe I could try that. Maybe I could do some of that or adopt that habit. And then maybe come back in 6 months and take it again. It has 100 different ideas for things you can do to foster happiness and positive emotion yourself. I set up a very easy URL for people. It's tinyurl.com. So tinyurl.com/happy audit. Happy audit. And
wonderful.
If they go there, or when they go there, there will be an invitation to give me their to fill in their email address so we can mail it to them. And I will also invite them to join my monthly coaching newsletter called Happiness at the Speed of Life, so that they can kind of get a regular monthly feed of new ideas to foster happiness.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. Jim Smith, the Executive Happiness Coach, has joined us today on the Happiness Hangout. It's been wonderful having you, Jim. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
And And what I'd like to do is take just a moment to thank our sponsors, AirServe of Strongsville and AirServe of Mentor. That's AirServe, AIRESERV.com/Strongsville or /Mentor. And the Magic Happens magazine, and that is themagichappensnow.com. You can catch me writing articles at yourtango.com and, of course, on Twitter at Happy Hangout. So thanks again, everybody, for listening in. Again, thanks to Jim Smith. And from the Happiness Hangout, we are signing off, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Hi, this is your host, Lori. Want to get more happiness? Check out all the free readings, activities, and my blog at my website. Want to learn how to deal with life's challenges from your positive core? Check out Empowering Yourself to Happiness class, done totally online. You can find it all at www.happinesshangout.net. www.happinesshangout.net. Come explore and feel better wherever you are. This is Lori Peters with the Happiness Hangout. I provide presentations on happiness and well-being to businesses, schools, and anyone involved in wellness and professional days. Check out tons of free resources and activities also at my website, www.happinesshangout.net. Feel better wherever you are. Help us grow the Happiness Hangout Show. Become a sponsor. Businesses and nonprofits, get your info out there to thousands of my listeners all over the world for just pennies. Individuals can also sponsor one or more shows, and you get a shout out to your favorite charity. Several packages available. Come see what you get and put out there what's important to you. Go to www.happinesshangout.net. www.happinesshangout.net for more information.